Now that we are recording, could you please repeat that?
Okay to record this.
Thank you. Okay. Any last comments before we introduce Josephine? So Marianne has a question. She's on the train, so she can't talk. Does anyone use one pass? Oops, I lost it. Does anyone use one password or a dummy password?
I do.
What's one password?
One pass is a, I don't know, a company or a tool. It's called One Pass. And on my Mac, it stores all of my passwords. It generates passwords and logins. And, you know, you can autofill from it. And you just have to keep your, you know, keep it up to date if you happen to change, so you don't end up with five passwords and logins for the same website. But yeah. I don't know anything about its security. I just know my son said do it so that I didn't have passwords flying around all over the place.
Well, Josephine has just written that she does it. She uses one password, so that's probably a signal that it's good.
Yeah, 1Password is a password manager that will store your passwords encrypted either on your own local machine or on their servers, whichever you prefer, and you then decrypt those passwords yourself using a master password. So the idea is instead of having to remember each of your different passwords, you encrypt them all with 1Password, but then it becomes very important that you remember that 1Password, because if you forget that one, you lose access to all of the others. So it's a little bit of a trade-off.
We all need a tattoo.
Okay. There you go.
Okay, let's introduce Josephine. Josephine Wolf is an associate professor of cybersecurity policy and has been associated with the Fletcher School at Tufts University since 2009. Her research interests include international internet governance, cyber insurance, security responsibilities and liability of online intermediaries, government-funded programs for cybersecurity education and workforce development, and the legal, political, and economic consequences of cybersecurity incidents. Her book, You'll See This Message When It's Too Late, The Legal and Economic Aftermath of Cybersecurity Breaches, was published by MIT Press in 2018. Her writing on cybersecurity has also appeared in The Slate, The New York Times, Washington Post, The Atlantic, and Wired. Prior to joining Fletcher, she was an assistant professor of public policy at the Rochester Institute of Technology, and a fellow at the New America Cybersecurity Initiative and Harvard's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. She received a PhD in engineering systems and an MS in technology and policy from MIT and a bachelor's in mathematics from Princeton. As a student, she also spent time at Microsoft, the Center for Democracy and Technology, the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, and the Department of Defense. So let's welcome Josephine. Thank you so much for being with us and enlightening us to this very serious matter.
Thank you so much for having me. I think this is such a wonderful forum. Susan, thank you so much for your remarks to start us off today and kind of think about how technology intersects with individuals and the people using it, which I think is something that people like me who spend a lot of time thinking about systems at the macro level often lose sight of and is always so important to be brought back to. I have a few slides that I'm going to share sort of going through on the theme of thinking about digital rights. First of all, how we get some of the language around thinking about things like privacy as a right and what that means and the ways in which it is and is not a protected right, particularly in the United States, that I want to talk a little bit about at a high level. And then I want to do some very specific sort of mechanics of how data is collected and what sorts of tools are used when you're online, and give you a little bit of a sort of vocabulary for thinking about what are some of the different mechanisms whereby your data is collected, what are some of the tools that you have that you can use. And mostly what I'd like to do is save some time for questions for discussion, because I think that's also really important when it comes to talking about digital privacy and sort of what options you have, whether tools like 1Password are helpful or not. So I want to do all of that. And I'll say right off the bat, I have to run teach a class right at 1:30. So I'm going to sign off a little bit before what I know is your usual ending time. But in the grand tradition of academics, I'm going to try not to do all of the talking. So let me share my screen quickly and see if I can pull up some slides. All right. Can you see those?
Yes.
Excellent. So I want to talk about a couple things. I want to start by talking a little bit about sort of the idea of having digital rights and what that even means. There are certain rights that we know are protected, that we know are enshrined in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights. But there's also a lot that's sort of not very explicitly protected, and kind of obviously perhaps because of when the legal rights and foundations are laid down in the United States and in most countries, most stuff relating to digital technologies explicitly is not actually enshrined as a right. And so when people start thinking about this 10, 15, 20 years ago, kind of what sorts of rights do you have around your online communications and activities, they start looking for kind of what are some of the historical roots we could maybe trace this back to, because so much of the legal system, so much of our sort of protections around rights are really focused on this idea of trying to find historical precedents that we can link them to. And the most important one when we talk about privacy in the United States is this paper that comes out in Harvard Law Review in 1890 by Samuel Warren and Louis Brandeis. And it's this attempt to articulate a right to privacy. And I think one of the things that often gets really lost in conversations about kind of controlling and owning your own data is it's not just that we don't have codified rights around digital privacy in this country. We actually don't really have clear rights around privacy more generally. And so there's this attempt a little more than 100 years ago by Brandeis and Warren to say, well, what if we tried to derive a right to privacy from what does exist in the Constitution? Becomes an incredibly influential article, right? If you ever study privacy in any context, this is almost always the starting point, the first thing that people make you read. And it points out, right, and this is, again, sort of something that I think surprises people when they go back and read the Bill of Rights and understand what rights actually are protected, that there's no right to privacy enshrined in the Fourth Amendment, which is probably the closest thing we have to protecting your digital communication. So when we think about sort of, can the government seize and read your emails? Most of the time, what we come back to is this idea that that is something covered by the Fourth Amendment. But the Fourth Amendment doesn't use the word privacy. The Fourth Amendment says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. And I want to sort of call out a couple things here. The first is that for 60 years at the beginning of the 20th century, the interception of communications is not considered a search or seizure, right? So the only thing the Fourth Amendment protects you against are unreasonable searches and seizures without a warrant. And when law enforcement first starts tapping telephone calls, when they're first sort of developing the technology to intercept synchronous communications, right? And this is different from like intercepting your written letters, because those are clearly your papers. Those are clearly covered by the Fourth Amendment. If I'm going to go and take your letters, that's definitely a search and a seizure. The question becomes in the 1920s, well, what if instead I've just placed a little tap on your telephone and now I'm recording your, listening to your conversation? Is that actually a search? Is that actually a seizure? Especially if I did it by attaching something to like a wire outside your house. I never even entered your property. I never even sort of did the physical part of searching or seizing. And so there's a sort of landmark Supreme Court case in the 20s that says, no, there's no search and seizure. when you intercept somebody's real-time communications. And then 40 years later in the 60s, the Supreme Court reverses that and says, actually, we think there is a real protection in the Fourth Amendment to your communications, even if those aren't written down or sort of in some physical form. And those are the cases from which we get this idea of a reasonable expectation of privacy. Right. So that whole idea that you have some reasonable expectation of privacy, that that's a legally protected right, doesn't come from the Fourth Amendment. For many, many years, it's not even considered to be extended to ephemeral communications, communications that can be intercepted without entering your home, without sort of conducting some kind of physical search. And the just sort of getting to that point takes decades and decades and decades, and still leaves open a lot of very important questions for online communications. So that's a fight that's really waged around telephone communications. Telephone communications give a rise to this distinction that we still use today of saying, okay, the content of your telephone conversation is going to be protected under the Fourth Amendment. So if I want to actually listen to what you're saying on the phone, I have to go and get a warrant. But there's going to be this separate category called metadata. And metadata is everything that's not what you're actually saying in your conversation. So the phone number you're calling, the phone number you're calling from, any information about the call, what time it was made. And all of that is not going to be protected. And that's also going to extend into the internet era. So when we start looking at interception of online communications, there's going to be this similar distinction made in which we say, okay, the content of your emails might be protected by the Fourth Amendment, but your IP address, the IP address that you're sending this to, any location information, all of that is going to be considered metadata and not going to be protected. And perhaps the sort of most important bucket of data that you get with digital communications that you didn't get before, and so we don't know sort of what the rules are supposed to be, is this real-time location monitoring, right? The idea that everywhere I go, I'm carrying in my pocket a phone that knows exactly where I am, and how protected is that location information? Does the Fourth Amendment cover it, right? That's one of the sort of ongoing legal battles that we've seen play out a couple times in the Supreme Court, and we're still kind of working out the edges of. So when we talk about digital rights, what we're talking about is sort of trying to stretch much older ideas of rights to, you know, not be unreasonably searched and seized, to have certain protections of your property that we're now trying to kind of stretch in somewhat new and sometimes kind of counterintuitive or ambiguous ways to apply to digital communications, to apply to new types of rights that we never knew we were going to need, and so we didn't necessarily make any rules for them. In that paper that I mentioned in 1890, what Warren and Brandeis do is they try to sort of draw that extension. And this is, you know, long before the internet, this is before even sort of telephone communications are widely rolled out. They're worried actually about the technology of the photograph, right? They're worried that because it's now possible to take photographs, famous people are having their privacy invaded, are having pictures of them published in newspapers. And so they're trying to take this idea that you have a right to property, right? That you have protection in your person and property. And they're trying to stretch that a little bit and say that also means if you have a full protection in person and property, that you have the right to be let alone. This is their language, right? Very, very commonly cited line. Gradually, the scope of these legal rights broadened, and now the right to life has come to mean the right to enjoy life, the right to be let alone. The right to liberty secures the exercise of extensive civil privileges, and the term property has grown to comprise every form of possession, intangible as well as tangible. And this is a line of reasoning that's going to be really important for digital communications as well, right? The idea that your property encompasses your intangible property, the bits, the packets, the stuff you can't really touch, the stuff that doesn't need to be physically searched and seized in order for somebody else to have access to it. And similarly, this idea of kind of a right to be let alone, which is never enshrined in any government document, which is just sort of something these lawyers and judges are putting forth in a law review article, is going to be very influential for the way that people in the United States and all around the world think about kind of what would a right to privacy mean. And they talk a little bit about sort of photograph technology and the ways in which that threatens people's privacy. And I just, you know, I think it's always important when we talk about the internet to keep some of that historical context, that the ways in which we now worry about the internet were also the ways in which people worried about the telephone, worried about the camera, worried about all of these technologies that came before. And so as we sort of try to rebuild these ideas of rights to suit modern circumstances and technologies, I think it's helpful to sort of keep in mind how many times these same conversations and concerns have been aired in other contexts. I do want to flag a couple other places where sort of the right to privacy comes up. One is in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights from 1948. Article 12 says no one shall be subjected to arbitrary interference with his privacy, family, home, or correspondence, nor to attacks upon his honor and reputation. Everyone has the right to the protection of law against such interference or attacks. So when the United Nations decides to sort of start getting involved and thinking about digital privacy, this is one of the sort of fundamental rights they come back to a lot. This idea of privacy sort of enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and then later codified in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And just to sort of reinforce the idea that this is not just about what the U.S. courts and what the U.S. legal system respects, I want to give you a very brief excerpt from a very long ruling that came out of the Indian Supreme Court 4 years ago. And this was a case that was brought around the enormous biometric database, which India has been building up for everybody who lives there for many years now. And that project is sued. And the sort of resulting lawsuit, which makes its way up to the Indian Supreme Court, is really focused on the question of, is there any right to privacy in India, right? And that's how ambiguous this is in a lot of places, right? That there's no clear kind of, is this some legally protected concept, or is this just something we've invented and now think we want? The Indian Supreme Court decides in 2017 that there is a right to privacy in India, that is something they want to protect, that there are certain sort of core ideas there that they think are really essential. And the language they use in their ruling, kind of significantly to my mind, absolutely echoes Warren and Brandeis, absolutely goes back to that 1890 article. The right to be let alone is a part of the right to enjoy life, they write. This is, again, exactly the language that Warren and Brandeis try out 130 years earlier. The right to enjoy life is in its turn a part of the fundamental right to life of the individual. Privacy is the constitutional core of human dignity. So there's this idea that this is, you know, not a peripheral, not a luxury thing. This is an essential thing that everybody should have access to. And then the challenge becomes trying to sort of figure out what that means, and particularly in my world, what that means in a digital context. To say you have some protections of privacy, for the most part, especially in the United States, what it has meant is there are certain restrictions on what kinds of data the government can collect about you. So if law enforcement wants to read your email, if law enforcement wants to have access to certain information about what you're doing online, often, though not always, there are sort of a very familiar set of processes that involve showing probable cause and getting a warrant, doing all of the same things or many of the same things that they would have to do in order to be able to search your house, right? So again, that metaphor of physical property is really powerful in U.S. law. And when we're thinking about kind of what's protected under our rights, that idea that our digital existence is sort of our property and should be treated as such is often a very powerful thing. What there's not, and what I want to sort of talk about for most of the rest of my time today, is a similar set of protections around private industry. So I'm happy to answer questions about government surveillance and interception and warrants if people are interested. But I also want to take some time to think a little bit about kind of the most unregulated space to my mind, which is not what can the U.S. government collect and know about you in your online life, but really what can all of the companies that you interact with online collect and know about you? And that's a space where not just the United States, but certainly the United States in particular, has been very reluctant to set any boundaries or kind of impose any guardrails. So instead, what you have are a lot of private companies that are by and large setting their own rules and vying with each other to see who can gain the most customers and figure out whether privacy is, you know, ever a selling point for those customers. One of the first stories that I start with when I teach online privacy is this article in the New York Times from 2012. So it's almost a decade old now. And it starts with this kind of famous anecdote, or kind of famous in my world at least, about the marketing department at Target, the store, sending out flyers to people advertising diapers or formula or other things that parents of small children, infants would need, and sending out these flyers to people who don't even know they're pregnant yet. Right, sort of that the analysis of what people are buying and who they are and their demographic has gotten so good that Target can actually figure out before I can whether I'm pregnant based on what kinds of things I've been purchasing and what my shopping patterns look like and where I live and how old I am and all the other stuff they know. And it's a sort of big moment for thinking about how powerful is this data collection process, right? How much, not just how much information are we kind of shedding with everything we do, but how effectively can that be aggregated? Can that actually be put together to be more than just the sum of its parts, more than just, okay, here are all of the things Josephine likes to buy when she goes to the store, to say, oh, we actually know some, you know, much more personal and private things about her that she didn't realize she was revealing when she started buying this kind of laundry detergent or that kind of cheese or whatever. And I think this is an important starting point because it's also very much the response in many circumstances to people saying, well, you know, I don't have anything to hide. I'm not worried about, like, somebody's going to find out that I eat a lot of cookies or I eat a lot of chicken. So what do I care if people know what I'm buying at Target, what I'm buying at the grocery store? And I think, you know, when we talk about privacy, when I talk about privacy with students, that nothing to hide argument comes up not infrequently, right? That, you know, well, of course people know what I'm buying. If they were at the grocery store watching me put things in my cart, they would know that way too. It's not a private thing. And I think part of what's different when we talk about digital data collection and analysis is that the scale at which that's happening is so unlike anything else that we've seen before. So yes, it's true that, you know, for a long time, somebody could, I suppose, follow you around a store and watch what you were buying and collect that information manually. But when it's being done as consistently for as many people as it now is, and when that data is being put together, not just what did you buy at Target, but also what did you buy at these 15 other stores that are all selling or receiving data from the same set of data brokers who can put all of those different pieces together, it becomes a sort of different thing. It becomes a different kind of data collection and how much is known about you and how kind of comprehensive and thorough it is. So starting all the way back a decade ago, people are starting to think about what does it mean for all of these different companies to be collecting information about us? And those are online companies, but they're also traditional brick and mortar retail stores like Target that are purchasing data about their customers, collecting data about their customers, finding new ways of sort of putting all of these pieces together to learn most of the time what to advertise to them. Right. There are other things that can be done with this data, but by and large, the data that's being collected about you on the internet is being used to sort of segment you into as narrow a specific piece of the population as you can. So that we can say, you know, it's not just I know where she lives and I know how old she is and maybe I know something about her income bracket, but I know exactly what kinds of television shows she watches. I know exactly what her favorite hobbies are. I know where she's traveled for the past 5 years, right? The granularity, the detail is just unlike anything we've ever seen before.
Josephine, can you tell us something? It's maybe obvious, but how are they collecting the data? Because are they collecting it from our credit card slips? If we paid cash, would they not have the data? Are they collecting it from our searches? How do they know what TV we're watching? So can you just say a little bit more about how this data is being collected?
Yes, I promise I'm about to say a lot about that. It's a great question. And I'll say it's a little different in 2012 than it is now, right? Because we've continued to see those technologies evolve. So in 2012, when this article comes out, it's mostly two things. It's mostly sort of frequent shopper club card type stuff where you get a Target, you know, card and you swipe it for some sales or something every time you shop. And that is linked to a profile for you. So they know everything you're buying there. That's one way. And the second way is Target's buying data from companies called data brokers. And the data brokers are collecting data about you, usually from websites. And that's what I'm going to talk about now, is sort of how websites collect data about you. And there are kind of two main ways of doing it, or two categories of collecting data. One is what we call first-party collection. And that's if the website you are visiting is collecting data about you. So if I go to tufts.edu, then they're going to collect some information about me directly. They're going to say, what IP address is this coming from? How many other times have you visited our website before? What website are you coming from to get here? Stuff like that. And that, I would say, is generally kind of not regulated and not something people worry about a lot. There's a sense of, okay, you've chosen to go to this website. You probably know that they're collecting some information about this session with you. The kind of data collection that allows for sort of putting that together across all of these different websites and all of these different types of data is what we call third-party data collection. And that's collecting your data by websites that aren't even the website you're visiting. So if I go to tufts.edu, Tufts is collecting some data about me, but Facebook and Google and other companies have also embedded little trackers on that website that they're using to collect data. And usually sort of the deal there is they're collecting some data and they're then selling that back to Tufts. And saying, look, we've put together the data about the people visiting your website with data about what those people do all over the internet. So now you know much more about them. It's not just these are people who are kind of interested in your university. We also know where they live. We also know how much money they have. We also know what kinds of jobs they do. We also know which of them, you know, did really well on the SATs or whatever it is. And so there are these two different kinds. And the third party collection is, I would say, really where kind of the focus of most privacy advocates and most people who worry about the cross-site tracking. And by cross-site tracking, we just mean sort of putting together what you're doing on Amazon with what you're doing on Google, with what you're doing on Ravelry, and sort of getting a really complete picture of all of the stuff you do online instead of keeping each of those websites and your activity on them a little bit more separate, a little bit more siloed. And the way that this works, the way that we actually kind of piece together this person who's on this website is the same as this person who was on this other website, is by linking that session information to a particular set of identifiers, right? So depending on what website you're visiting and how much they know about you, that could be your name, that could be an email address, that could be a phone number, that could be something called a MAC address, which is linked to an individual device. So this laptop I'm talking to you on right now has a MAC address. That MAC address is the same no matter what website I'm going to. So if a data broker company gets a 1,000 different data sets and they're trying to figure out, okay, who are the people who are represented in a couple different places in these data sets, these are different ways that they can say, show me every entry that's linked to this particular MAC address. Show me every entry that's linked to this particular email address. There's also this technology called cookies. Cookies are a little bit of code that's sent to your browser from a website. And it basically just says, okay, we're going to give this browser a little nickname or a little sort of code name with usually a number. And every time we see this browser visiting this same website again, we're going to know it's that same person. So if you've ever like done some online shopping and you put something in a shopping cart, and then you don't buy it and you close out and then you come back to it and it's still there, the way the website knows, oh, this is the same person who put this thing in her shopping cart earlier, is with a cookie usually, right? It says, oh, this was the same browser we saw visiting a couple hours ago that put this pair of pants in their shopping cart. Let's put that pair of pants right back in there because we think they might want to buy it. And then more recently, we have things called browser fingerprints. And that's because people started blocking some of these cookies and other tracking technologies. And so companies came up with more advanced ways to say, oh, because of the way your browser is configured and the font and the magnification and the different types of text encodings that you use, we can, even without any cookies sometimes, get a pretty unique picture of what your browser is. And so one thing I do want to sort of point out about this is these techniques evolve over time. And as we start getting better at blocking some of them, tracking companies come up with new ways of trying to do the same sort of stuff that are sometimes harder to block. In terms of who's doing this, the vast majority of third-party trackers on the internet are operated by Google and Facebook, which shouldn't surprise you. Those are the two companies that make the largest sums of money from personalized advertising. So those are the two companies that have the most at stake in being able to tell advertisers, we can get your ads in front of this very specific group of people, you know, 32-year-old women who were born in Medford, Massachusetts, and who like to ride horses and are allergic to gluten, or whatever the kind of, you know, very, very particular niche is that an advertiser is trying to reach. And there's a lot of power in sort of concentrating these trackers, because if Google controls more than 80% of them, that means that, sorry, if Google is tracking more than 80% of the web traffic that is happening all over the internet, then that means that Google can put together information about more than 80% of the things you do online, right? And the next highest is going to be Facebook, which is already a huge drop off. Facebook's going to be closer to about a quarter of online activity. And then you can see sort of the other companies that are interested in getting more into the personalized advertising space trailing somewhere far behind them. But by having one or two companies that can do so much of this tracking, and most websites now, I will say, have, you know, Google trackers and Facebook trackers. Most of this is stuff that's not unique to one particular company. So when you visit a website, you may well find that multiple different third-party trackers are collecting information about that session. What this actually looks like when you load a website, right? So here's a little graphic of it from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. You type in the URL, the website that you want to go to. That website usually shows up with some ads on it, unless you use an ad blocker. Each of those ads is coming to you from a different place. That's usually not the website you've loaded, right? So if you go to the New York Times and you're seeing ads on it, only the content on the New York Times, the actual articles, is coming from New York Times servers. The rest of the content on the web page, the ads, is coming from a whole bunch of different ad networks that are sort of using what they know about you and about your browser to sell your eyeball, to sell sort of that space in front of you on the screen to different advertisers. And this could be coming from a bunch of different networks, even on the same page. You could have a couple different ad systems all loading different boxes on the page with different ads based on slightly different profiles of your data. So there's another New York Times article more recent from Farhad Manju in which he actually sort of tries to get a handle on how many different trackers there are for each of these ad spots on the screen that he's using sort of over the course of a day of normal internet activity. And he writes this really interesting piece about sort of trying to map and visualize the literally hundreds of different trackers that are following him from site to site. And this over here is a graphic from the piece in which he's trying to show that sort of for each website he goes to, there are often dozens of different trackers, even just like from the same company. Google might be sending ads from a bunch of its different ad network channels to the same website, collecting information about him and what he's doing online and piecing it back together. I want to take a moment to talk about identifiers because they're a really important piece of how this gets put together. So I said sort of each individual web page you visit, each individual session, we would sometimes call it online, is not automatically connected to everything else you do, but it's often tied to very particular identifiers. So that could be something like a cookie. That's that little piece of code that tells a website, oh, this has, you know, this user ID, link it to any other attempts to access this website from the same browser. Could be something like an IP address. So every time we go online, we get assigned an internet protocol address. That can change. So when I'm sitting here in my office, I have a different IP address than when I'm at home. But it's something that's always available. So there's no way to block the IP address. You need the IP address to be able to get online. Whereas something like a cookie, you see more and more websites giving you the opportunity to say, no, I don't want to accept cookies. No, I'm not willing to have that code sort of installed on my browser to be used to link back to me. There are other things that we see sort of companies and trackers starting to use in this space. And the really crucial thing for a tracker is, first of all, how unique is this identifier. So if you look at something like an IP address, it's, you know, pretty much always going to be unique. Ditto, a cookie is going to give you a very unique ID as opposed to everybody else who's visiting that website. But it's not always long lasting, right? So your IP address, for me right now, this IP address I'm using only lasts as long as I'm sitting here on campus. And as soon as I go to a coffee shop, as soon as I go home, I'm going to have a different one. So that makes it a less good identifier than something like a cookie, which will sit on my browser on this laptop no matter where I take it until I make the decision to delete it. There are a lot of different ways that we sort of think about different intermediaries being involved in this process. And I want to talk about some of them explicitly because I think one of the things that's often confusing and hard about this digital tracking ecosystem is there are so many invisible players involved in it, right? So I've mentioned Google and Facebook, which are very large players, but there are also a whole bunch of other companies that you've never heard of that are busy selling and repackaging and trying to sort of put together different data sets from these types of tracking technologies. And in the way that you sort of set yourself up for this, if you're, for instance, trying to deliver cookies to a user, is that every time a request is sent to a particular website saying, I'd like to load this website, please, from your browser, that website has contracted with a third party to say, can you send a cookie to all of our users so that we can know if they're coming back to us, right? So this is not something that's done without the consent of websites. And I think that's also a really important point. It's not like you go to the New York Times website and completely unbeknownst to the New York Times, 40 different companies are tracking you. That's actually a service that the New York Times is paying for. That's something that they want in order to know more about who's visiting their website in order to have access to these cookies and be able to use them to track their users across multiple sessions. In general, when you load a website, here's an example for loading the federal financial aid application, which is a government website in the United States. When you make that request, you have to share some information about your browser, about your connection with the website that you're connecting to. And one of the sort of early investigations looking at Facebook trackers pointed out it's a little weird that like every time you want to go fill out the financial aid application, the government has contracted with Facebook to do tracking on that website. So as soon as you try to load that page by typing the URL into your browser bar, that triggers a third-party request to Facebook.com in the background, right? You don't see that request. The Facebook website, of course, never loads unless you ask it to, but it sends to Facebook the information about your IP address, about your browser, about any cookies that it's seen before, anything else that the federal financial aid website has decided it wants to send on to third-party trackers. And I think this is sort of the most important thing to understand about online tracking, maybe, is that it's not each individual website doing it itself. It's each individual website contracting out to the same set of very big players to say, can you please collect this information for us? Every time somebody visits our website, we're just going to forward you a bunch of information about them so that you can tell us more about our users or install cookies so that we know kind of what they've been looking at or doing with in previous times they've visited. And this can sort of look like a lot of different things. So here's an example of a cookie, just because you hear that word thrown around a lot. I think it's perhaps useful to see what kinds of information gets passed to trackers like Facebook or Google. It will tell them what kind of browser you're running. So if you look at this window here where it says user agent Mozilla/5.0, all right, that's saying this is somebody who's using Mozilla Firefox. They're using this particular version of it. They're running this operating system, right? So it's a lot of information about your computer and your browser, which again, you have to share in order for the website to render. And now that website is just turning around and sharing that with Facebook. It's telling them what language you're using, right? Saying this is a browser that's set to US English. It's telling them what website they're trying to get to, where they're coming from. And it's telling them, here are the cookies that we see associated with these users. And the cookies here are just like big numbers. Let's say, okay, C user equals 10002609524854. That's just a number this user has been assigned in the past when they've connected to this website. And now that's being passed on to say, aggregate this session with any other sessions that had a user who had that same cookie in their profile. So this is the kind of information that's being passed on. And again, I would say it's not on its own in isolation, perhaps particularly scary or particularly important, right? All we know here is this is somebody who uses Mozilla, who's interested in financial aid, who's using this operating system and speaks English. Where it starts to get more frightening is when you start putting together this piece of information with every other piece of information about every other thing that you've done online over the course of a day, a week, a year. And that, I think, is sort of the other piece that can make it difficult to convey the importance and convey kind of the scope of what's at stake with online privacy, is that each individual piece of data often looks pretty uninteresting, looks pretty sort of obvious or apparent or not worth protecting in a big way. And as that sort of continues to be aggregated by Facebook, by Google, by other third-party trackers, you get this accumulation where all of these individual little cookie numbers that are being used to link together your sessions can add up to a fairly thorough and complete picture of who you are and what you're interested in and what you're doing on the internet all day. I want to talk about a couple changes in the past couple years and sort of how this landscape has shifted. So Apple in 2017 makes a really significant set of changes to its Safari browser. I don't know if any of you use Safari. It's, I would say, on the whole, one of the more privacy-conscious browsers, together with Mozilla Firefox, because it's made by a company that doesn't make its money largely by selling personalized ads to people. And so what Apple decides is we're going to change the ways that third-party trackers can use cookies. So if I run a website and I'm selling things and I want to, you know, remember what everybody has in their shopping cart, I can use first-party cookies still on Safari. But if I'm outsourcing that tracking to a third party, if we come back to that third party tracking context, those cookies are not going to be allowed to be used for longer than one day. It's a really kind of radical change in terms of how people have been relying on third party tracking to say there's a 24-hour time limit and then all of those cookies are going to be removed from third-party access. And after 30 days, all of the cookies are purged, first-party or third-party. Huge shift, very upsetting to a lot of the companies that really rely on cookies to be able to know whose browser is this, what kind of ad can we sell. It goes into effect about a year ago, a little more than a year ago now, and blocks all third-party cookies. Right. So if you ever open up a website in Safari, and I recommend doing this if you have an Apple computer, an Apple device, it will actually show you in a little button next to the browser bar how many trackers have been blocked for any given website. Right. You can go in and it will say, we've blocked 3 Facebook trackers. We've blocked, you know, another 4 Google trackers and these 10 others. It's kind of interesting. It gives you a little bit of a sense of sort of everywhere you go online, how many different companies are trying to follow you and what they're trying to do. It's, again, a really radical decision from the standpoint of online advertising. It's a decision that Apple is well poised to make because Apple makes most of its money from selling devices. It doesn't make most of its money from selling ads. So it has a very different business model from Google. It has a very different business model from Facebook. And it's trying to see sort of whether people will care if it promotes privacy, whether it can use that as a selling point for customers. Facebook in particular is really upset about these changes. There's a kind of interesting ad campaign that Facebook launches against this set of changes in which they say, you know, this is really bad for small businesses. What we do here at Facebook is we help small businesses serve ads to the customers they want to reach. And if you block all of our third-party trackers, then we can't do that anymore. To me, it's a sort of a wild presentation of what Facebook is for and what their core business is to say, you know, this is bad for small businesses, because really who it's bad for is Facebook and Google, which are quite large businesses. But there's a sort of enormous amount of back and forth and fighting in this space over who's going to allow which kinds of trackers. And the browsers in particular have tremendous power here, right? There are only a small number of really influential browsers. There's Safari, there's Internet Explorer, there's Chrome, and there's Mozilla Firefox. And each of those companies that manages a browser gets to make a lot of decisions about sort of what kinds of tracking do we allow. And each of the companies behind those browsers has very different priorities, right? Apple's a very different company from Google, is a very different company from Microsoft. And what they see as sort of their core business model and how important tracking is to them dictates a lot of sort of where they're going to come down in terms of what kinds of tracking they do and don't allow. Now, as this is happening, right, so we're seeing huge pushback in the past year or two to the widespread use of cookies, which has been really kind of the fundamental way that most information is being tracked across websites to say, okay, here's sort of an identifier we can come back to over and over again. Most people never bother to delete them until Apple decides we're going to automatically delete and block them. So they last a long time. As that becomes harder to do, as browsers like Safari say, we're not going to allow this, you get new techniques for trying to track people online. And this is where the sort of rise of browser fingerprinting comes in. And fingerprinting is about sort of trying to say, let's not rely on being able to pass somebody a cookie anymore because we can't trust that the browsers will always let us do that. Let's just put together such a detailed picture of each device that even without having to give a little bit of cookie code to it, we know exactly which device it is every time it connects to our service, right? And that's trying to put together every piece of information that's possible to gather about the version of software you're running, the language configuration, the font preferences, the defaults for your entire sort of computer setup to establish what's called this fingerprint. That will allow us to say, oh, there's, you know, only one other person who comes to my website who has a computer set up exactly like this. I bet this is the same as that other person who visited yesterday. Let's link their profiles. So it's a way of sort of doing the same thing as the cookie, but without actually having to have a browser allow you to store a cookie on the individual browser. Fingerprinting, this is from sort of the reports on browser and device fingerprinting. You can either fingerprint the browser, just looking at the configuration of the browser, or you can try and fingerprint an entire device and say, you know, even if I'm using different browsers some of the time, can I put together what I'm doing on Safari with what I'm doing on Chrome with what I'm doing on Firefox? Looks at many characteristics of your mobile device or computer, including screen resolution, operating system, and model, and triangulating this information to pinpoint and follow you as you browse the web and use apps. It's also useful for mobile phones. So one thing we haven't talked a lot about is how data is collected about you from the services you use on your cell phone, most of which you do not access through a browser, right? So everything you do sort of on a laptop, on a home personal computer, you're usually going through a browser to open up a web page. And sort of that's when all of the first and third party tracking starts. When you're using a smartphone, usually you're using apps. And each app is kind of operating its own little data collection process. And they usually have a lot of information about you because you're required to make an account and to sign in when you use an app, but then the process of aggregating that information from all of those apps to create a complete picture of who you are is again going to be something where some of this device fingerprinting can be useful and can say, oh, I know whose phone this is. This is the person who has a phone set up with exactly this background and exactly this screen resolution and exactly this operating system and so on and so forth. Here are some of the different things, right? Just some of the kind of technical things that fingerprinting looks at what kinds of JavaScript are enabled or not enabled, looks at the color depth, the list of fonts, the list of HTTP headers, the language, whether or not do not track is going to be turned on in the browser. So all of the kind of small settings and checkboxes in those settings that you go through, each of those can be used to sort of slightly more uniquely identify your device or your browser. There are some tools that you can use if you're curious that the Electronic Frontier Foundation has put together to help you get a sense of sort of how uniquely can your browser or your devices be fingerprinted. This is one called Panopticlick. Is your browser safe against tracking? And you can go and sort of visit from your different browsers and ask, is your browser blocking ads? Is your browser blocking invisible trackers? Does it unblock third parties that have promised to honor certain do not track obligations? So there are a whole bunch of ways to sort of try and assess your own safety and security against these different tracking mechanisms. And there are also a whole bunch of ways that people are now working on trying to figure out, can we circumvent some of the things that make it easier for people to protect themselves online? And I want to wrap up by talking quickly about mobile device tracking. The big difference here from sort of personal computer tracking is there's really not that distinction between first and third party tracking, because you can't grant any permissions to an app when you download it without allowing all of its third party partners access as well. So when you click the buttons that say, yes, I agree to download this app and give my data to this company, by doing that, you've granted access to all of its third party partners. And you can't then do the thing that Safari does where it says, okay, we're blocking all third-party tracking, because it's kind of part and parcel of downloading the app and granting access to the app developer at this point. There are also a lot of new identifiers available on phones. So you've got phone numbers. That's a really useful identifier. You've got international mobile subscriber identity numbers. You've got international mobile equipment identity numbers. So there are a lot of really sort of useful permanent identifiers on mobile devices that make it easier to do some of this type of tracking. And when you download apps, and those of you who have smartphones will have seen this, and you're sort of granting permissions to different parts of your phone, this is again going to be an opportunity for sort of aggregating information across different apps and across different services. There's also something called beaconing in geo-tracking, right, in which the devices that we use to connect to wireless networks can also scan any connections when mobile devices are being used, either over the Wi-Fi networks or over Bluetooth, and listen for sort of which phones are around us and use that to know something about where you are and also who you are, if they have some information about what your device looks like, and do that to collect some what we call geo-tracking information, or information about where you are and where you're going, what kinds of stores you might visit, what kinds of travel you might do, that sort of thing. All right, I want to wrap up there because I know I've got about 10 minutes left before the hour and then a little more time after that. There are a whole bunch of other types of tracking technologies, but we don't need to be encyclopedic today. There's also something called a tracking pixel, where you put a specific pixel into a website, and that is used to sort of track information about, has anybody opened this email, right? That's something a pixel in the email can detect and send information back about. And so I just, I want to emphasize there are a number of different ways of doing this. Some of them we've got good ways to protect against. Many of them we don't, right? Many of them, if there are pixels in your emails, the only way to sort of protect yourself against that is to not open those emails or not enable images in your email. There's something called session replay tracking, which is coming more and more into vogue in the retail space, where websites actually hire third parties to record your entire session with a website. So it's not just sort of what did I put in my cart, but they actually make a full screen recording of where did I move my mouse? What did I hover over? What did I look at? And then they try to analyze that to learn more about how long did I spend on which parts of the website and what did I think about buying? If you've ever if you've ever looked at something on a website, not purchased it, and then gotten an email a day or two later that says something like, this item is still waiting for you, with a picture of something you looked at, that could be one of the ways that they're sort of collecting information for trying to do that. And all of this is sort of data that's being collected, not entirely, but almost entirely, for the purposes of selling ads to different ad networks. And the way that works is also totally fascinating in its own right. There are these instantaneous, what's called real-time bidding auctions, where when you go to a website, that website knows some amount of information about who you are, and all of the ad networks that are supplying ads to that website are going to go to the different advertisers who they've partnered with and say, here's what we know about this person. How much money are you willing to spend for us to show your ad to them. And there's, I mean, obviously there's no person on the other side of this because it has to happen just in the time that it takes for the website to load. But all the different advertisers are going to have set limits and say, you know, I'll pay up to a hundredth of a penny for somebody in that particular demographic. And what you'll see are the ads from the companies that have bid the most to be in front of eyeballs like yours, right? So that's how the question of sort of what ads you see connects to all of this data that's been collected about you. Is they're then going to use that profile to sell your eyeballs to different advertisers and see who's willing to pay the most to get their content in front of you. All right, I'm going to stop there and stop sharing because when I'm sharing, I can't see all of you as well. I appreciate all of your time. I know I've talked for longer than I meant to, but I want to take the rest of this time for comments, for questions, for anything that you would like. Yeah, Linda.
So that's, I so appreciate that you're in this field and doing what you're doing. I mean, I feel like you just gave us enough to be pretty, I feel pretty slammed by what's being done behind my back and out of my view and that I can't possibly ever understand. So I just do appreciate that there are people who are watching out for us and paying attention to all of this. It's actually incredible. So I have two questions about the tracking. Why would the FAFSA people want to give information to Facebook? Like what does Facebook have to do with it? Why Facebook? So I was curious about that. And then the second thing I wanted to ask is, as a therapist, I'm a psychotherapist, and so when I work with a client, sometimes they present situations to me about a part of the world that they are involved in or activities they're involved in which are very new to me or I don't know about. And so I will do searches on my computer to find out about them. And I'm realizing now that those searches about activities that have nothing to do with me are now part of a profile about me. So I just was curious about that too. So those are my two questions.
Yeah, they're great questions. So the first one, sort of, why is FAFSA partnering with Facebook? There are a couple reasons, right? Usually, I'm pretty sure FAFSA, the website, doesn't have any ads. I'm just going to go look as I say that because, of course, it's always possible that I'm wrong. So usually the reason that a website would partner with Facebook or Google is because they wanted to monetize their website. They wanted to get money by selling ads on it. And Facebook and Google would be big ad networks that could sort of place ads there and collect data about who was coming to those websites. And the idea is that sort of the more information you have about the users who are coming to your website, then the more money you're going to make off your ads because you're going to be able to sell people, not just I can put your ad in front of somebody who's visiting my website, but I can put your ad in front of somebody very specific who's in a demographic that you're interested in.
Let me understand this. So the FAFSA is a U.S. government operation. Yeah. So the government is getting money from Facebook because they've just given Facebook data about me that now Facebook is creating ads.
So, sorry, I should have been clearer. Most websites that partner with Facebook and Google are doing it because they're monetizing. FAFSA is not, because FAFSA is not a monetized website, to my knowledge. FAFSA is instead trying to collect information about who is using FAFSA, right? And they have decided that the best way to learn who's sort of interested in this program and beginning their application but not completing it or considering but not necessarily following through is to go to one of these large third-party tracking companies and ask them to put together that information with all of the other information they have about users. So it's a way for the U.S. government to try to learn more about who's interested in that program.
But I don't understand why the U.S. government doesn't create their own tracking program of all people who have gone to the FAFSA site to keep it just, you know, that feels very strange to me to throw it over somewhere else when this is our government and people who go to FAFSA, They can all be tracked, all the data, whether they finish the application or they don't. It just seems so strange.
Yeah, I think one way to think about it is that what most websites are trying to understand is who are the people who consider engaging with our website but don't, right? Who are the people who think about applying for financial aid but don't? Who are the people who think about buying something from us but don't? And those are the people where what Facebook knows is really helpful to pin down. Right, because Facebook knows things about what those people do in other settings, whereas FAFSA only knows what they do on the FAFSA webpage. So if you're trying to figure out sort of who are these people who were losing, who were not getting to sort of stay and fill out this application or something like that, then you really need to go to a third party because you need to know something else about them, because all you know about them at that point is they didn't fill out our application.
It's not a business. Who cares if they don't? I mean, who decides if I decide I don't want to give all that information or I don't want, and you don't need a loan, so I leave. Anyway,
you're definitely not wrong, right? You could certainly run a website in which you said I don't want to know anything about who the people are who look at my website and don't use it. That is a rarer mindset than you might expect it to be. I would say to sort of say, you know, whatever, we don't care about those people.
All right. What about my second question?
Oh, sorry. Remind me your second question.
Just that I'm a psychotherapist and I'm sometimes doing searches on things that really aren't pertinent to me at all, but are pertinent to the people I'm working with. And so, but it's forming a profile somewhere of me that could be quite inaccurate.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing I would say about all this data collection is it's still not foolproof, right? You still get advertisements for things that are totally wrong for you. And it's very easy to sort of mislead in some cases, right? If I listen to a song in Spanish on YouTube, I often get shown ads in Spanish, right? So it's not the case that because they're collecting so much information, they necessarily always have the most accurate picture. I would say if anything, they're collecting so much information that it can very quickly become inaccurate if you look at something that's a little outside your interests or your usual profile. But you're right. All of that does generally sort of go into that same profile and become part of the information that's collected about you.
And so is the government, for example, collecting a profile about me separate from all this ad? Because I get that you're saying what's driving most of this is ads. But is also the government collecting profile information about us?
No, mostly not in this country. Mostly this is being done in the private sector. And that comes back to sort of the idea that most of the constraints on what kinds of data can be collected are constraints on government, not constraints on private industry.
Okay, thanks.
Barb.
Yes, hi, thank you. I enjoyed it very much. I have two questions. One is I live in Europe part of the year and we use a VPN, a paid VPN. I don't know if people know what it is, but it's a virtual private network. So there are a lot of times we want to be in the United States, especially to view movies, and we can fool some of the people, but what it does is that you can pick anywhere in the world, like to watch a football game. You'd want to be in the U.S., let's say. And so we can have ourselves be in Canada, Germany, England, U.S., what have you. And it's really interesting because all of the German ads go away and they think we're in Boston, Mass. Or something like that. But how private are those networks? Supposedly they're supposed to protect you from all this other stuff that you just talked about. But certainly, I still get, when I go into Facebook, I get ads that are made for an American living near Boston, let's say. So they know, so I'm not really in Boston, I'm in Switzerland. I just wondered how private they are, because my husband uses this all the time, regardless of where he is.
Yeah, so what a VPN protects you from is from the local internet where you are, knowing what you're doing online. So if you're in Europe, then you connect to a VPN. That VPN tunnels your internet connection through the VPN provider. So if the European government is, you know, or whatever country you're in is watching, all they see is that you've connected to a VPN. They don't see what you're doing. And for that same reason, because of that tunneled connection, you can make it look like you're coming from somewhere else. You can make it look like you're coming from wherever. But what it doesn't do is change your browser. Right. So that affects sort of how the packets from your machine are being routed. It's not changing the fact that your browser is still sort of holding all of the cookies that it held before and can be identified as you. So it's unlikely to change the advertising in a big way. What it does is it gives you a little more network protection around what that network you're connected to can see about what you're doing.
Okay. And my second question is this. I run a nonprofit organization and we use mass mailing through one of the major companies. And it's really interesting because it's fascinating. I mean, you can't believe you can see who opened, who didn't, how many times they opened, whether they donated or not. But a lot of times, and this is mostly family members say, oh yeah, I get your emails. And it never shows that they've opened the email. So I don't know if they're lying or what, but, is it possible that if they open on an iPhone or a phone that it's not going to show up? Although this will also tell us how many people opened on their phones. I just wonder, you know, I never say anything to them, but, you know, people who haven't opened the last 20 emails say they get all our emails.
Well, they may get them. They may just not open them. Is what I would say, right? So what the email is actually tracking is, did anybody click on this and view it? Whereas what they may mean is like, I saw that in my inbox, but I never actually went in and viewed it. It will show if they open on their phone. There are ways of trying to disable the tracking technology, but they're extremely rare. Most people are not using them. Mm-hmm. So it's possible they are receiving all the emails. They're just not actually reading them is what I would say.
And I don't know if people have noticed this, but there's a new thing, and I think it just happens on the phone, that if you get a mass mailer, it will say this is coming from a mail company. Click here if you don't want to open it. You know, even though these are people who've already subscribed. I think that's a new thing that Apple's doing to warn people. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Barb V.
Before we had all of the social media, I used to get a publication called Adweek that told me who the major clients were that were looking for somebody to advertise and who got the contract and the price of all of that. Is there a publication or more than one that is doing that for what you're talking about in terms of what's going on with third parties and behind the scenes?
That's such an interesting question. Not to my knowledge. I think that's so concentrated now in Google and Facebook. That there's nothing sort of publicly available, at least. I'm sure there are teams within those companies that are very focused on that sort of work, but I'm not sure there's really a kind of public analog anymore.
Okay, thank you.
Mary Margaret.
Would you be willing to share with us your personal/professional judgment, your sort of the moral side or the ethical side of all of this from your perspective? You've been just wonderful laying it out. And I'm just curious where you might help us in that area.
So you mean sort of in practice what I do for protection?
Not so much the mechanics of what you do, but more how you think about or feel about these trackers, the Facebooks and the Googles of the world.
So I think the things that scare me the most and that feel like they're sort of the most ethically concerning, the most different from anything we've seen before, really comes back to issues of scale. Right, really comes back to the idea that it doesn't worry me necessarily in a lot of contexts, at least, if some companies know some things about what I'm doing online, right? If I go to a store's website and I look at some products or I buy some products, that seems totally reasonable to me that that store would keep some records of that, would send me emails about, you know, and I think that the parts that really worry me, and you can see this perhaps a little bit in kind of the evolution of what people are trying to block, is that stuff where those pieces get put together, where it's not sort of, I have one profile with one website and another profile with another, and each of them knows a little bit about me. It's the industry in which Google and Facebook and some others are able to kind of take all of that and map it together back onto an individual person. So when I think about sort of from a policy perspective, what are some of the limits I would like to see? Those are the limits that I care about most, right? And this is entirely, you know, a personal judgment thing. I think there are people who feel I don't want anybody to know anything about me online. I personally don't see a radical kind of ethical failing in companies keeping track of their customers and collecting some information about what they do and don't do when they're using their services. I see a pretty significant shift in kind of trying to aggregate that across everything you do. And that's the part that also feels newest to me. If we're sort of talking about what does the internet change, what's the kind of stuff that we didn't really see before it? I think being able to sort of aggregate at that scale is the part that feels most ethically questionable, most new, and most like the kind of stuff I'd like to see policymakers taking a harder look at and thinking about, you know, do there need to be some rules around how this works and how freely this can be done and how easily this information can be packaged and sold? So those are, I'm not sure this really answers your question, which I think is a more profound question of sort of what are the ethics of all of this and how worried should we be? And those are really important questions that I think I probably don't have very satisfying answers to. I do think that it's important to sort of, for me at least, and for engaging in the policy space, to be able to find some middle ground between this is all terrible and it should all be stopped, because I think that train has really left the station at this point. And well, here we are and it's all happening and we might as well just give into it. And so for me, that kind of comes back to that first party versus third party tracking divide.
Thank you.
Lee.
You're muted, Lee. Still. I think I sometimes see a script on my computer that says, do you accept this cookie? What happens if I say no?
A great question. Usually what happens is nothing. Usually you can go to that website and they just don't put that little piece of code into your browser, so they don't know that it's the same person who visits the website a little while later. Occasionally you'll get a website that says, well, in that case, we can't provide the service, or we can't load, or we can't show you this interactive content. But I would say on the whole, most of the time when I say no, I don't accept these cookies, it makes no difference at all.
Well, that's good. I have one other quick one. That is, it's one thing to throw ads at us. It seems to me another thing to put an email on my screen that is going to try to rob me of money. Is there any way to differentiate between the collection of data that allows both those things to happen?
So I think those are pretty distinct industries. Right. The people who are sending you phishing emails and trying to steal your money are not actually people who are using the same tools and the same data as the Facebook ad network. So I agree with you. They're very different. I don't think that right now the data collection process that underlies the advertising ecosystem is actually sort of serving criminal enterprises. Or I certainly haven't seen any evidence of that. I think those are pretty distinct sort of markets at this point.
Well, where do they get their information then to know to send me that email?
So most of the time their information is much less good, right? Most of the time they find email addresses just by scraping websites where people's email addresses are listed. And they do a Google search on you and find out, oh, you live in this area, or you might be, you know, related to this other person. But that's rarely coming from actually purchasing data and sort of working through these third-party data brokers. And I think you'll see that if you sort of look at the amount of information they have about you, it's rarely as sort of granular as what exactly did you do online yesterday? And it's much more sort of, we know the name of somebody who might be a relative of yours, or we have some information about where you might live or something like that. The other thing that criminals often do is when there are big data breaches, when somebody steals a lot of your information, they often use that to say, you know, I know your password because your password was just leaked as part of a big data breach, and to try and use that to scare you into giving them money or something else.
Well, for example, I used to get a lot of emails, a lot, 3 or 4 or 5 from Chase, supposedly from Chase.com, wanting me to respond. I never fortunately have responded. But how did they know I had a Chase credit card?
Oh, they probably didn't, honestly, right? Chase is a big bank. There are a lot of people sending phishing emails from Chase, from Bank of America. That's probably just a volume business. That's probably just sending that out to as many email addresses as they can collect and seeing who falls for it.
They probably also know I'm 81 years old.
Right. Age is something that you can often figure out on Google. Right. That's the kind of information that you don't even need third party trackers to collect a lot of the time these days. But it's usually a very different ecosystem from the advertising one, for what that's worth.
Well, your talk was terrifying, but very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Mary Rose.
I heard a couple of years ago, Shoshana Zuboff, who wrote, you know, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, and she was more scary than you. And she did say verbally that she had no apps on her phone. She had an old phone. She absolutely would not put her information anywhere, which was kind of scary. But her solution, she said, you know, this has only been around for 20 years. We can fix this. And she seemed to think that legislation was the way to fix this or control it in some way. And what do you think about that?
You know, I'm a policy professor, so I also think legislation is a really important piece of this. I think there are a lot of ideas that have been floated for what that might look like. We've seen in the European Union, the General Data Protection Regulation, which is one attempt to sort of give people a little bit more ownership of their data. It's a much harder sell in the United States where these companies are based. Right. Facebook and Google have much more sway in Washington, D.C. than they do in Brussels. There's much more fear that you're going to sort of squash innovation or hurt the U.S. economy if you go after their core business model. But yes, I'm with her in thinking that this is a policy problem. I think it's a very hard one to sort of get momentum behind in the United States. But I'm not despairing. I think we may get there. I just don't know that we're going to get there very soon.
Thank you.
Susan.
I had a question and a comment. The question was, when FAFSA, for example, employs Facebook to get information, is Facebook allowed to use that information to take it, aggregate it with their other information and sell it on, in other words? They are.
Yes, absolutely.
So that private information those people going to FAFSA might think is private, can be sold all over the place.
Yeah, I would say think of it as right, both Facebook and Google run enormous online ad networks. So people who want to buy online ads almost always go to one of those two companies and say, you know, I'd like to put these ads for my product or service in front of this kind of person, right? I'd like it to be, you know, people of this gender in this age range in this region with these interests or these political leanings or whatever it is. And so what Facebook is doing is it's usually not even selling your data on to other parties, though it can do that and it does sometimes. It's saying to their advertisers, okay, we found somebody who's perfect for you, right? We've got somebody who's exactly in the age range. And the fact that you visited the Tufts website and whatever you did there is part of how they build that profile. It's one tiny part because they've got trackers on, you know, hundreds of thousands of other websites as well. But it's part of that profile that they're then selling to their advertisers.
My comment is that all of these personalized ads, I was thinking about this, they can be quite useful because you don't get ads for things you're not interested in. But on the other hand, they're contributing to the polarization of society, because I don't see what other people are interested in. I only get the ads for what Facebook thinks I'm interested in. And I don't know what the rest of society, you know, how they think.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's true, not just of advertising. We worry about that on Facebook newsfeed and what kinds of news stories you're shown. Yes. And all of that sort of thing, that kind of the more detailed and specific a profile can be created about you, then the less likely you are to ever see anything that wouldn't exactly fit into your profile, for sure.
Yes, but that's sort of more obvious, but I was only just realizing that ads work the same way too.
Yes, absolutely, right? There's a strong desire from the advertisers not to show you anything that you wouldn't like, because then they've just wasted money on putting that in front of you instead of putting it in front of somebody who might actually be interested in it.
Okay, thank you.
All right, I think we're going to take one more from Barbara.
Oh, I really appreciate it. Go ahead if somebody else has one.
Oh, I meant really Barbara's feet. Sorry, there's too many Barbaras. I'm sorry.
We must have all been born the same year.
I'm wondering, is it risky to be buying? Can you hear me? Am I on?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, thanks. Is it risky to buy something on the web with Amazon using a bank card or a Visa card? Is it easy for hackers to get this information and use it to steal money from you? And it also, my brother, who lives in a small town in California, his bank account was hacked because there are these small time hackers who are going after, you know, smaller victims. And he went to the bank and they said, better not to have a checking account, just have a savings account. That's going to be safer. So those are the two questions. Is it safe to use my Visa card on Amazon, and how to make my bank money safe?
Yeah, it is safe to use your credit cards on Amazon, both because they have, you know, a lot of investment in security and in protecting that payment processing, and also because we have a lot of protections built into our credit and debit card system. So if anybody did steal that, you would not be liable for any of the charges. So it's in fact one of the safer ways to spend money online, as opposed to like putting your account numbers directly into a web page for transfers, where you have fewer protections. I don't know as much about the idea that it's safer to have savings accounts than checking accounts. That's not something I've heard before. That may be true for people who know more about banking. I will tell you, I have both a checking and a savings account, so it's not a practice I've heard about or engage in myself, but it's possible that's something people now tell people to do sometimes. I apologize. I'm going to have to run, but I want to thank all of you so much. It was such a pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah.
And please do stay in touch. Let me know if you have other questions. I'm happy to follow up with all of you.
Thank you so much, Josephine.
Take care.
Bye-bye. But I think there was another part to your question, Barbara, about, and can criminals somehow connect me to the purchase and to my credit card somehow and through hacking? She was saying that seems like it's safe. Does that seem right?
The Visa cards and bank cards have some sort of
protection. They have protection.
That's the question I didn't ask her was, is it a good idea to occasionally buy something really weird that you would never think of buying, or to buy some things at CVS that, you know, are totally out of your profile, just to, you know, confuse the issue so they can't really quite pin you down like they think they can. Anyway,
I'm going to be nice. Why not?
It was an excellent talk. Very, very useful talk.
We have a few more minutes for comments. People
Susan,
want
I love your information was very, very scary.
Yep. Any other comments or questions that people have? Josephine is gone, but Susan is here. I'm going to see if I'm going to go to Ivo because you haven't spoken yet.
Hi. My question was from 2001, and I always wondered what happened to my laptop. I had an idea, and I started following website after website in the Middle East and got to this one site where the person who had been in the World Trade Towers and the artist program, you know, was totally anti-US and it was very, very obvious. And once I opened that website, my entire laptop blew up and I lost everything. And I wondered, did that just happen simultaneously or did I cause that by being at that very odd website? So that was my question. And then the second one was a little simpler. Is PayPal safe?
So PayPal is safe, yes. Yeah.
You know, a friend of mine's father, very innocently, he was, you know, home and wanted some towels or something, and he got in touch with a site in Turkey, and he ordered his towels from Turkey, and he was actually, I believe, contacted by either the FBI or some government organization that they actually knew that he had gone to a website in Turkey and that he had ordered something and they questioned him. So there is some sort of watching. I don't know what kind, but
strange.
Yeah. Any other comments or questions from people who haven't spoken? Linda.
I was going to ask about the genetic data that for organizations like 23andMe or Ancestry.com, you know, and her opinion on, because it seems to me like all technology, there's a use that is potentially good and there's a use that's potentially, you know, exploitative or, you know, will exploit you. So for that, I just wanted to know if there were debates going on, policy debates about that particularly, and in what she personally thought about sharing your genetic data for the purpose, you know, that those people who might aggregate it and use it for, you know, for free data to, you know, find out maybe more about your characteristics and what you're maybe predisposed to, and then marketing you some solutions to that. I mean, that could be good. I debate that in my own mind if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Maybe Susan, would you be willing to write the two questions to Josephine? The one I will ask, which is, if we are using any kind of Middle Eastern websites, what kind of tracking, government tracking there is on that, and also what kind of information is shared around these Ancestry.com kinds of genetic information and genetic origins information. Would you be willing to ask her since you know her?
Well, I'm not quite sure. Well, I don't really know her.
Oh, well, okay.
I invited her.
Yeah, if you wouldn't mind, she offered, if you wouldn't mind asking her those two questions, yeah. Maybe you could let us know during reflections next week.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what the questions are.
The first one is if we're visiting sites
in the
Middle East.
You see, I can believe.
Is there government surveillance? Is there currently government surveillance on sites that are known countries where terrorists have come from? Are we being tracked in terms of those sites? And then there was also Linda's question about if we're doing any of the genetic kind of following our gene pattern back to through Ancestry.com or 23andMe, those kind of sites, and we get the results through the computer, is that information also being used? And how is it being used?
What worries me there is insurance companies, health insurance companies, who might increase your premium by a lot if you've got the wrong genes.
Well, but this isn't only genes. This is what country my ancestors came from. So it's that profile. People have been called.
No, but Susan, you're
the point. Yeah.
It's not just that though. It's, you know, do I have a genetic predisposition to something? And do I have a health condition, a predisposition to something?
Yes.
I don't know if the insurance companies are allowed to, you know, increase your premium because of individual issues.
But they might find another reason to increase your premium. Yeah,
right.
To know that information. You know,
they would tell you. But the privacy of those kind of pieces of information, because I think we are told that if you participate in a program like that, somehow you're now in a data bank.
Yeah, well,
your genetic,
you know, they found the Golden State killer by tracking, they had a bit of DNA information and they managed to track relatives with the same genes.
Yes, so anyway, Ivel, did you want to add to the request?
Yeah, with the deviant gene ending on DNA ancestry, so far it hasn't affected me. So that's helpful.
Okay, thank you.